I think that one of the key things about sleep for people in the perimenopause is about making sure that you wake up at a regular time each day, every day, if you can. Wouldn't you say, Zoe?
Yeah, absolutely. I think regularity is so important. And I think my tip would be to think about things that you're doing in the day. We know it is the phase of life where people do reduce their activity. So the average step count reduces over the perimenopause. And these things just happen naturally. But that, again, it will impact on your sleep. And we know that exercise and activity can help boost the sleep drive, and it can lead to a much better night's sleep.
Welcome to This is Perimenopause, the podcast where we delve into the transformative journey of perimenopause and beyond. I'm one of your hosts, Mikkel.
And I'm your other host, Michelle. And we know firsthand how confusing, overwhelming, and downright lonely this phase of life can be.
Join us as we share real-life stories and expert advice to help you navigate this journey and advocate for your best health.
We used to think menopause signaled an end, but really, it's just the beginning.
We are so excited to have Dr. Maya Shadell and Dr. Zoe Shadell on our podcast today. Maya is a clinical psychologist and Zoe is a general practitioner. They are also sisters and they've combined their sleep expertise to found the Good Sleep Clinic. We were giddy when we discovered that they have a focus on perimenopause and sleep disturbances. We know many of you aren't sleeping, so let's dive in and have Maya and Zoe help us find better sleep. I am so excited about our guests today.
Me too.
Do you remember that social post? I think you had posted it about there being a new rule that you only have to work, or you can only work the same number of hours that you slept the night before. And our social just blew up because no one is sleeping. And That's what actually prompted me to do a Google search. And I was delighted when I came across Zoe and Maya, who are with us today to talk about the clinic they founded called the Good Sleep Clinic. Welcome, Zoe and Maya.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
We're so excited. It's something we all need to know more about.
Absolutely. So without further ado, maybe you could start by telling us why you founded the Good Sleep Clinic.
Yeah, sure. Well, Zoe and I were working in very different places. So I'm a clinical psychologist and Zoe's a GP. And I was, at the time, I was working in a sleep disorder center as part of my job. And it was in this big hospital in Sussex in England. And there was this sleep disorder center that used to offer a really good program to people who had insomnia. But there was such a huge waiting list. And it was really, really hard because we'd have so many referrals and we wouldn't be able to offer the treatment that we really wanted to, you know, there just wasn't enough. And I was speaking to Zoe about this because Zoe, as a GP, saw so many people with insomnia. And I'd often speak to her about how to manage the kind of medication withdrawal type questions as well. So one of the things that we talk about is, you know, how often people get quite stuck on their sleep medication. And I'd be speaking to Zoe about this. And we realized after just discussing it a lot that actually we were both seeing so much of a sleep problem that just wasn't being touched, really. And I think, I don't know if it's the same in Canada, but in the UK, it's a little bit tricky with sleep because on the one hand, you have a kind of mental health offering. So if you had anxiety or depression, you'd go down the kind of mental health road. But if you had a sleep problem like sleep apnea or restless leg syndrome or one of the kind of more medical sleep problems, you might be referred to a sleep disorder clinic. And there was this massive group of people who just couldn't sleep, who had a diagnosis of insomnia, but there just wasn't the treatment for them at all. And it was kind of confusing because we knew that there was this brilliant evidence base that said that actually there's stuff that really, really works. So we thought, this is crazy. We need to be able to make this more accessible. And we got our heads together and we founded the Good Sleep Clinic. And I just remember we spent a long time really mulling it over. Really, we used to go for these long walks. We both had we had babies at the time, actually. And bless our dad, he would like look after our babies as we would go walking around the fields and like brainstorming. And then we'd come home and do like post-it notes on the wall. And then we'd hear a baby crying and mum and dad would be like, it's fine. We've got them. It's all good.
And that's amazing. So
that was how that's it was amazing. Kind of founded.
I love it. That's awesome.
We wanted there to be a really big focus on evidence-based treatment. So we were really wanting to say, look, this is what's on offer. This is what we know works. And actually, it doesn't take that long to do. So we tried to set up the Good Sleep Clinic, and we were offering one-to-one therapy. And Zoe was also started working with people a lot more in the menopause. And Zoe's always been a women's health specialist. And so that worked really well because, of course, so many women going through the perimenopause were finding that they had sleep problems. So I think that we've actually always had a lot of women who are going through the perimenopause that are really interested in the work and wanting to access treatment. And yeah, and since then it's just grown, and we've got now associates who offer work in the Good Sleep Clinic, and Zoe's now set up Myla Health, which is the menopause focused clinic as well. So it's kind of all taken off from there.
It's really interesting that when we first started the Good Sleep Clinic, our focus, we didn't have our target audience of women in the menopause at all. And it's really interesting because we had this real special interest in sleep, and then on the other part of my working life, I had the special interest in women's health and I was a menopause specialist. And it seems really stupid, but at the time, I didn't put them together. We didn't set out like that. And then as soon as we launched the clinic, of course, it just became obvious. Certainly, the most common demographic of people that we are seeing are women in the kind of age range of the menopause transition. And it just became so obvious. Why is there not a better solution for these people? That really became quite a focus for us. And as Maya said, I also now set up Myla Health, which is where we can give more of the kind of hormonal treatments and things like that. So not necessarily so sleep specific, but it just means we kind of can approach it from lots of different angles.
Two things that resonate there for me is, I think, one, we generally as a society, we tend to be dismissive of sleep. It's almost, I would dare say, seen as a weakness in many cultures and corporate culture. Two parts to this question. Why is that? Why do you think we're so dismissive of sleep is the one part. And also, to your point, why do we know so little about menopause, and why has it taken the two of you to figure out that there needs to be a specific program and no one else has done this before?
I'll talk to the first bit, if that's okay, because I think that there is, like you say, there is this massive sleep problem. And what we're finding is that actually people are saying that for a long time they didn't prioritize sleep, but also they really felt that they didn't need to. And why is that? I think a lot of it is to do with what we value, and as a society, what we've put value on, which is about sort of productivity and working long hours and saying, you know, we are at the top of our game and we're really producing a huge amount of stuff here. And so, you know, even when you look at things like medical school training, you know, years ago, sleep wasn't prioritized for medical students at all, you know, and they were expected to get by. And these are people who are essentially, you know, going to be really important in establishing whether or not you're living or dying. And yet then we're not thinking that we need to prioritize their sleep. I mean, now we're really looking at, actually, you know, how we need to value that. And actually, it's really important for people to get the sleep that they need. So I think that there's been a growing research that's come out actually looking at why it's so important. And of course, now we understand that it's now linked to all sorts of really massive health concerns and poor health outcomes like cardiovascular disease and cancer and dementia and obesity. And there's actually really good evidence now that says that if we don't get enough sleep, it really does lead to these difficulties, you know. So I think we're just starting to understand it, but why we haven't looked at it before now is kind of crazy, really.
I think it's partly as well because it looks like you're doing nothing. So I think there's just this fundamental misunderstanding, isn't it? It just looks like you're doing nothing. And so it kind of, you think, oh, well, surely I could use that time a little bit better. But I, like Maya said, I think more recently we know that you're not doing nothing, that actually there's so many important things going on. But I don't think we do that. And as Maya said, like, the impact on working lives of getting the right amount of sleep is huge. We know that that's when your brain, you know, develops. You develop your creativity, your, you know, analytical thinking, your memory is all while you're asleep. And so we know that leaders are better leaders with sleep, that workers are better workers with sleep, you know, everything like that improves. And yet it has been so devalued over time. So, but I think there is a growing movement to understand it more.
And I think people are starting, there was that old adage, when I was in my 20s, I used to say all the time, oh, I'll sleep when I'm dead. Well, if I don't sleep, it's going to, like, I'm going to be dead sooner, right? Like, and now people are starting to recognize that and realize, like, this is really important.
Yeah, it is. And actually, you know, there's a theory that says we probably came from a state of sleep. So awakeness has come from being asleep, that actually our kind of default position was sleep. So we really need it.
Oh, I've not heard that. Wow, interesting.
Funny enough, though, that's actually a bit of a challenge for us, because one of the things that happens is when you start to focus on your sleep, it can make sleep worse. And there's this real paradox that goes with insomnia, which is that actually the more you focus on your sleep, that it sort of just evades you. You know, you're trying so hard to get the sleep that you need. And then the more you focus on it, like, the less sleep you get, which, as you can imagine, poses a bit of a tricky conundrum in terms of how to treat insomnia. Because on the one hand, you're saying to people, right, this is really important. Your sleep is so important. We really want to help you get more sleep. And now we want you to stop feeling like it's important and take your focus off sleep and do loads of other stuff. And it's really about trying to hold in mind that, it is really important, but at the same time, we don't want you to focus on it too much, because that will be bad for you.
I've actually heard in at one of the sleep clinics in North America somewhere that they, when you go in for your overnight testing thing, they actually say, try not to fall asleep. Do your best to stay awake as long as possible. And I guess just that, like, simple twist in the terminology helps people actually fall asleep faster.
Yeah, it's a proper technique that we use called paradoxical intention. And it can be really useful, because when you try to do something, it's really hard. But if you try not to, it's really hard not to.
I think this is a great time to dive into, like, how do we actually get some sleep? But what is sleep? What is insomnia? What is a good night's sleep?
Yeah, sure. So let's start with what is sleep. When you are asleep, you know, your eyes are closed. It's like being unconscious. But the key thing that defines it is what's happening in your brain. So you have a certain set of brain waves that happen in sequence. And these brain waves change, and you do different things for your body and mind at different times. So you have slow waves, not so slow waves, rapid eye movement sleep. And these sort of happen in a sequence throughout the night. So that's what sleep is. How do you know if you're not getting enough sleep? So the recommendation is for adults to have 7 to 9 hours of sleep a night. Everybody's different, and there will be some people that are fine on 6 hours, and there might be some people that need 10 hours. Usually between 7 and 9 is about the right amount to kind of be healthy.
I don't get to sleep through the night. So I go to bed quite early. I've recently heard that maybe I should try and stay up later, but we'll see. But so I go to bed quite early, and then I sleep pretty well until midnight, and then I'm up, and maybe I just have to pee, and I'm back to sleep in a half an hour, or sometimes I'm up for an hour, sometimes I'm up for 5 minutes. Like, I think that's pretty common for people, and we get frustrated, but is it normal?
Well, what you're talking about there is your sleep quality, which really matters, as well as your sleep quantity. So when we say 7 to 9 hours, ideally, most of that would be continuous sleep, and that's how you feel better. That's the kind of, you know, most important thing for health. But actually, when you have very broken, fragmented sleep like that, you have poor sleep quality, and you're not going to feel as good the next day if you're having lots of waking through the night. So it's not so healthy for sleep to be broken up in that way. It is common, and it's normal, to have a little bit of waking through the night. So when you move through these stages of sleep that I described, about every 90 minutes, you come up to being a little bit more alert, a little bit more awake. And it's quite common. You might not even realize it, that you might have a little waking every 90 minutes.
That's when I hear my husband snore.
How many people come to you because their husbands are snoring?
Yeah, you know, that does happen.
There's also another thing that happens, which is that we get people who've got brilliant partners who sleep. Like their partners are like the gold standard. They could get Olympic gold medals in sleeping. And one of the things that happens is they're lying there awake and just looking at their partner who is just so easily sleeping.
Infuriated.
Enraged. Yeah.
They just feel enraged. And I honestly, I must do a research study on that, because I reckon it would be like 95% will have partners who are just the best sleepers ever.
Ugh. I used to say, like, sleep like a baby. They don't sleep through the night. My husband sleep like a husband. Yeah.
And it gives you an idea as well that this is what normal is like. So I think that you'll be lying there and you'll struggle with sleep a bit. And you'll think, why is it so hard for me when it's so easy for everyone else? And of course, it's not easy for everyone else at all. But in that moment when you've got someone next to you who finds it really, really easy, then it can seem like the whole world is asleep whilst you're awake in the middle of the night. And that can be a lonely place.
And so is that also my cortisol spiking when that happens? Am I getting agitated, irritated, which doesn't help me get back to sleep?
Absolutely. So there's all sorts of reasons why we have our sort of sympathetic nervous system kind of alerted and kind of go into gear. And one of the things that can really send us into that is particular thoughts about sleep. So if we have a thought, which is a really, really common one in insomnia, might be something like, oh no, I'm awake, I'm going to be exhausted tomorrow, and that will be my day ruined, you know, and actually starting to panic about the next day. And that thought in itself is enough to mean that your heart rate starts beating faster, your breath becomes quicker, your body temperature is pushed up, you might start to sweat. And of course, these are all normal reactions to that kind of fight, flight, freeze response that we would see when we're sensing that there's a threat or danger around, when of course the threat or danger is not like a bear that's creeping around the corner. It's essentially that we can't sleep. So in those moments, we try, one part of the treatment is trying to encourage people to do something differently, instead of getting kind of caught up in those thoughts and allowing yourself to be drawn into that kind of fear position. It's sort of almost about stepping outside of that and doing something a bit different.
Mikkel, I don't know if you want to ask, but I'm dying. Like, what do we do?
Yeah. So what do we do? And I think I also want to ask, what do we do for that circumstance? But if I could share what was happening to me in my early 40s, I was 42. And I'd had some issues with insomnia in my 20s, and I knew all the tricks. I can wake up anywhere and not look at a clock or a phone. I know all the rules and I follow them. I'm the gold star girl when it comes to, you know, health rules. But when I was 42, I would wake up and I didn't even have time to have the thought about, oh my God, I'm not going to get a good night's sleep. It was like I had been plugged into an electrical socket and could run 12 marathons and not be able to get back to sleep. So at 2 a.m. So I learned thereafter that that's probably perimenopause, but please tell us.
That's what I was going to come in. And I think that's where the perimenopause is showing itself. And this is what we see all the time. And this is where the perimenopause is so frustrating for sleep. So we think something like 60 to 80% of women are affected. Their sleep is affected when they go through this time. And the tricky thing is there's quite a lot about perimenopause that can affect sleep. And it's sometimes hard to know exactly what it is. But sometimes, for instance, it's obvious that it's some of the symptoms of perimenopause. So if you're having hot flushes and night sweats and you wake up and you can feel that surge of heat or you're sweating, it's sort of obvious what's waking you, right? Mm-hmm. You know, and that's really common. That might be going wrong. But I think what's harder is when you don't necessarily have those symptoms and the waking just comes out of the blue. And sometimes this can be the first symptom of perimenopause. And we know that the variation in hormones, exactly.
I was raising my hand.
The variation, yes. The variations in hormones can really impact on sleep, even in the absence of the other symptoms. So estrogen and progesterone contribute to healthy sleep and healthy brain function. And when the estrogen starts to vary and drop, we see more wakings, the sleep quality reduces, actually, we know if we study the sleep itself, the sleep architecture changes and we get less deep sleep really quickly. Early on in the perimenopause, this can happen. So it feels as though it's something you can't control almost. And it's often really hard to know what's causing it. But there is all sorts of things that we can do about it.
So what do we do? Please tell us.
So I guess part of it is thinking about the whole hormonal profile. So is there other causes? So you always want to look and see, is there something else causing you to wake up? Is there anything else going wrong with health? Is there sleep apnea or restless legs or something like Maya has said? So it's always worth considering those things. But then we look at that whole perimenopause picture. Are there any other symptoms you're experiencing? Is it actually linked to an increase in anxiety or mood disturbance? Because often the mood becomes flatter, the anxiety goes up, and you get that cortisol sympathetic nervous system activation. So it's taking a really holistic picture. Is it because you need to get up for a wee at night? You know, what is going on? And I think part of that is thinking about treatment options. And we do need to think about treating symptoms of perimenopause with something like hormone replacement therapy. If someone doesn't have a contraindication, if they can, if they are willing to, if they'd like to try it, it can be really effective. So we know it will usually solve hot flushes and night sweats. So if that's what's causing it, this can be a fairly easy fix. But it can also, even if you're not having any of those symptoms, really improve the sleep quality and quantity. So that's always something we would look to try if someone was willing and able to try first. If that isn't suitable, or if someone doesn't want to try it, or there's, perhaps a history of breast cancer or something like that, where usually HRT is contraindicated, then there's other techniques we can use. So I think Maya will talk a little bit about cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, but this can be really effective even when hormones are causing the problem, right? You think, well, if my hormones are going wrong, how can this help? But actually, we know we've got loads of studies and we know from using it ourselves, the techniques that you can use are really effective for women in the perimenopause. It can really help. So it might not stop you waking, but it can make it a lot easier going back to sleep.
You know what I really, really want to know though is if I'm up at 5 a.m. and I know that my alarm is going to go off at 6, like if I fall back asleep, I feel like I'm just in the deepest sleep of my life, but then I wake up and I'm groggy for like quite a while afterwards. So should I be getting up at 5 instead of trying to get back to sleep, or what do we do in that situation?
Okay, so I think this is a bigger question. So in that situation, I think you've got those options, haven't you? And it will depend a little bit about what's going on, what your situation is, how you're feeling at that time. But if you really can fall back to sleep, that sort of nice feeling of being able to go back to sleep, not having to start the day quite so early, might well be worth the payoff for that feeling later when you wake up, which we call sleep inertia. And that sleep inertia, actually, which is more significant in women and more significant in the perimenopause, like a lot of things, where you really feel groggy and drowsy when you get up. So it might be a reasonable choice to do that. But over the longer term, there might be more helpful strategies. And for instance, there might be strategies around changing the timing of your sleep, so to make you less likely to wake up at that time. And sometimes we know that if we can perhaps put a number of things in place to push the bedtime a little bit later, increase what we call the sleep drive to really keep you asleep for longer during the night, it might become less of a problem. I think what's really important and what we really don't want to happen too much is lying awake for a long time in bed and stressing about it. And so if you had that option of like, I've woken at 5, I've got another hour, but actually I'm going to lie here, I am going to be in my mind, I'm going to have a bit of racing mind, a bit of that sympathetic activation, then that isn't so helpful. Because what we do is we create really strong connections between that kind of being in bed and feeling anxious and not being asleep. And so we're kind of untying the connection that we should have, which is being in bed, being fast asleep. So if there's a choice of lying awake and being a bit worried and not feeling so good and actually getting up and doing something else, that's the right choice to make. So I think there's a kind of, there's a switch when you suddenly know, no, I'm not going to get back to sleep now. And it's usually about 15, 20 minutes in, you've been lying awake and you've had that hope you might fall back to sleep. And then you sort of suddenly realize, I'm not going to get back to sleep at this stage. And that's the time it can be quite helpful to get up and do something else and just change the situation.
Awesome. Thank you.
Zoe, could you tell us what the definition of insomnia is?
So insomnia is when you have difficulty either falling asleep at the beginning of the night, or you wake up in the middle of the night like you guys have been, or you wake too early in the morning. And everyone can experience these things. And you might experience what we call acute insomnia. So just one or two days where that happens because it's a situation where something's gone wrong, you're stressed, something bad's happened, you've gone on holiday somewhere new, whatever. But where it becomes what we call chronic insomnia or insomnia disorder is when that continues for a while. And so the definition is where you can't, you trouble sleeping for 3 nights a week or more, for 3 months or more. And it really depends on it having an impact on you in the daytime. So you might actually wake up early every day and feel completely fine, and then it's not insomnia. But if you're waking up early and you're getting up in the middle of the night and actually it's having an impact on how you feel in the day, that's when it becomes a disorder. And so it's, you know, the kind of things you can feel is exhausted, low, frustrated, struggling, worried about your sleep. And all of those things mean that it's, we call it a 24-hour disorder. It doesn't just affect your nighttime, it affects you in the day as well. And the other thing is that you have to have enough opportunity to sleep for it to be insomnia. So if you're just working really hard and you don't get into bed till 1 a.m. and you have to get up at 6 a.m. for work, that's not insomnia. You know, you can have not very much sleep, but it's when you've given yourself a really good chance to sleep, but you still haven't managed to have good enough sleep.
That's great. Thank you. I think everybody knows the word. I think few of us actually know what insomnia means. So thank you for clarifying that.
You're welcome. And I think the word gets really overused because we do use the word all the time, don't we? We'll just naturally say the word insomnia, but actually it is an important diagnosis to make. So like when I say to someone, well, I think you've actually got insomnia, they're a bit like, yeah, well, I knew that. I mean, I can't sleep. And I'm like, no, this is actually a real condition that we now need to, we've got real treatments, we've got evidence-based treatments available. And it's really different if you told someone they had asthma or diabetes. You know, you're saying, oh, you've got something, we need to treat it. Insomnia, it just lands really differently.
I was just going to say, and the treatments for insomnia, are those similar to what we've been talking about? Is it cognitive behavioral therapy? Are there other things you consider? And when are medications required or appropriate?
Yeah. So the first line treatment for insomnia is usually CBT for insomnia. And that's because it's the most effective thing we've got. And the effects last the longest. So you're teaching someone a whole set of skills that you can put into place so that actually they will be able to hopefully weather further sleep difficulties in the future. So it tends to last the longest. So that's why it's the first line. But it can be time consuming and some people will find it really difficult to do CBT for insomnia. So it's not appropriate for everybody. And then there are other treatments, like you say. So there's medications that you can use. So some of the sleeping medications that are available are short-term sleeping pills. So you can have things prescribed. You can buy over-the-counter antihistamines and things like that. But none of them are very good in the long term. So they all work pretty well for 1 or 2 nights or even a couple of weeks of poor sleep. But using them over the long term has got lots of problems. One, they're not very effective like that. But two, you can become a bit tolerant to them. So you need more and more. And some people will develop a bit of dependence on them as well. And they can have side effects like making you feel a bit sleepy the next day, giving you a dry mouth, or cause all sorts of other problems. So they're not great in long-term use. Melatonin is interesting. So melatonin, strictly speaking, is something we produce in our own brain. So we have a pineal gland. We produce our own melatonin. And it's not actually something that makes you fall asleep. So it doesn't work by sending you to sleep, but it sets the timing for sleep. So it kind of says, this is when you can fall asleep from now. This is the time that's right. So when people use it as a kind of sleeping pill, it's not actually very effective. So actually trying melatonin for insomnia, the studies suggest it doesn't really help that much. It doesn't help you fall asleep very much faster. It doesn't keep you asleep for very much longer. So it hasn't really come into the kind of treatment guidelines. But there are exceptions to that. And certainly, as we age, we produce less melatonin from the pineal gland. It can become a bit calcified. And in the UK, melatonin is licensed for prescription for people over the age of 55. So it's still only licensed for relatively short-term use, but we can prescribe it. And certainly some people will benefit from it. I don't think it's a hugely strong sleeping pill, and I haven't found it to be hugely effective in the perimenopause and menopause, but some people will respond really well for it. And so I think it's a really good option because it's really safe. It has very, very few side effects. It does not seem to have harm in the long term. So it's an option that people can try for sure.
The melatonin, because in Canada, we just go to the supplement store and get melatonin there. This is obviously a stronger version that's being prescribed over the counter.
So it's interesting you should say that, because actually the dose that works for sleep, we think, is the lower doses. So in America and Canada, you can buy doses over the counter. The first issue with it is that they are unregulated supplements. So actually, you don't quite know what's in them. And a study last year showed there was something like 700% difference in what they said on the tin to what was in some of those pills. So you really don't know what you're getting. But the actual doses that seem to work the best for sleep are the lower doses. So the regulated product that we do use in the UK, which is called Cercadin, is 2 milligrams, whereas often you're buying it over the counter in 5 milligrams or 10 milligram doses.
10 minimum, bare minimum. And I sometimes pop a couple of those.
Yeah.
Maybe have to rethink that strategy, Michelle.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think you introduced me to melatonin then, Mikkel, you and Aaron.
Really?
It was during Stampede. It was a sleep aid to get us to bed after maybe too much drinking.
Oh, I don't even remember. Okay. Yeah. Interesting.
Back in the day.
Well, if there's a timing element to it, it might be more effective, actually. And also, I am a fan of thinking you've got to see what really works. What works for you? You know, actually, it's not about having really strict rules and saying, well, this is not going to be any good and this isn't. It's about trying things and seeing what works for you. And there's all sorts of medications we can use for sleep. You know, for the right person in the right situation, you can try different things and try and help. But the reason we go to CBTI first is because, like I said, it's actually more effective and lasts longer than most of these medications that we're talking about. So that's why we tend to go for that first.
So you mentioned CBTI. I know what CBT is. I'm not sure about the I. Maya, maybe you could tell us what the I means and also delve into what cognitive behavioral therapy looks like, particularly for women in perimenopause.
Yeah, sure. So the CBTI, the I stands for insomnia. So this is a special protocol for insomnia. And, you know, like other CBTI programs, there's very much a focus on changing behavior and changing how we feel by changing our actions and what we're doing from day to day, but also by targeting how we think, what we think, and the way we engage with our thoughts as well. So I think that we're trying to target both the kind of cognitive side and the behavioral side, as we know that the way we think and the particular thoughts that we have around sleep can have a massive impact on how we feel. And the same with our behavior, and the same with what we do in day to day. And one of the things that we often go through with people in assessments, especially during the perimenopause, is trying to understand what behavioral pitfalls we might be falling into. And there are a ton in sleep. So an example of this might be if you are struggling to get the sleep you want at night, you might think, okay, well, I'm waking up loads during the night. I know if I get into bed super early, then at least I kind of maximize how much time I spend in bed. And it doesn't matter if I wake up 3 or 4 times. At least if I'm in bed at 8:30, I know that I'll have as much time as I need in order to sleep, get the sleep I need. So at assessment, we might go through all the different pitfalls that we might fall into. And I think that these are different for everyone. I think also where the perimenopause comes in is that I think there's also a load of other factors that are impacting on people during that period of time. One of the things I would say about CBTI is that it works, but it's not an easy thing to do, actually. So one of the criticisms for CBTI is that it can be quite hard to do, and you need a lot of motivation to do it, because some of the strategies that we use in CBTI can be tiring. So sometimes people say, you know, I just can't do that. And I think the perimenopause is a time where I've had more people describe a complete exhaustion more than at any other time. And I think that's because of everything else that's going on. And I think that, you know, it's a reflection of everything else that people are managing at that time, whether or not it's, you know, physical changes and symptoms that are coming about due to those changes in hormones, or whether or not it's due to, you know, aging parents and responsibilities with having to contribute in that way, or perhaps it might be relationship difficulties or teenage children who are going off to college or whatever it might be. I think there are all sorts of stresses and strains that can have a real impact. And of course, we also know that so many women have a lack of confidence and feel like their confidence massively drops and then drop out of the workplace. You know, so I think there's so many different challenges during that period of time that it can make embarking on CBTI quite difficult. And so sometimes we have people who've read the self-help manuals and they've said, you know, I've tried it a little bit, it didn't work for me, I'm not a massive fan. And I think often it's quite helpful to have someone guiding you through it.
And sorry, what kind of techniques are you guiding them through? What does it entail?
Yeah, so the behavioral strategies, there's two main behavioral strategies in the CBTI. One is called stimulus control. And what that means is we have to try and change our brain and our body's association with our bed and with sleep. So, you know, generally speaking, what you would really want to happen is you feel tired, you go up to your bed, you get into bed, and your brain says, "Ah, bed, that's lovely. This is the place that I sleep." And that association would mean that you find it easy to fall asleep. And what happens often in insomnia is that we develop these new associations, which are more like, "Oh no, my bed, this is the place that I'm up for hours and I don't feel good in this place and I'm anxious in this place." And also we then start to do other things in that space as well. So we might work on our bed, or we might watch TV, and we might chat, and we might eat, and we might do all sorts of things in our bed. And often we might lie in bed awake for hours, just either on our phones or just worrying and thinking through how awful it's going to be tomorrow when I haven't slept. Your brain starts to make those connections. So stimulus control is about addressing those connections and saying, we're only going to sleep in bed or have sex. So we try to make sure that every other activity that you're doing happens outside of the bed. And that means that if you're awake for longer than about 15 to 20 minutes in the middle of the night, we encourage people to get up and go into a different space. And that's for several different reasons. Firstly, it allows your sympathetic nervous system to calm down. If you're reading a book in another space, it can be really hard to actually come down from that place of panic and worry. So actually just changing the scene, mixing it up a bit, going into another room, reading a book can be a really great way of actually calming that reaction. But also it minimizes how much time you're spending in your bed awake. And again, it's coming back to that, really trying to reestablish the connection between your bed and sleep. And then the other big one, which I mentioned earlier, is sleep consolidation or sleep restriction.
But if you're keeping me from my bed and say, "Well, stay up later," I'm going to sit on the couch and I'm going to fall asleep there.
Yeah, and that is the challenge. There's no getting away from the fact that that can be a real challenge, especially, you know, if you're someone who, you know, wants to go to bed earlier. Staying awake in the evening is really hard. Really, it's about trying to catch yourself before that point. So it might be when you start to feel sleepy, you might get up and stretch and go into another room, maybe go into the kitchen, get a drink, come back again. You know, I've worked with a few people that when we've been doing it over the summer, they'll go for a little wander outside, maybe into the garden, have a breath of fresh air, come back again. And I think sometimes it's about And another person I worked with actually just put a little alarm on their phone every 10 or 15 minutes so that they're just kind of able to remind themselves just to stay awake.
Stay awake. Okay, I'm going to try that tonight.
Try it. I know it can be a real challenge, that one. And this is why it's sometimes helpful to think, is it best that I really stay up a lot later? Or maybe it's about bringing back my wake time. So actually, you don't have to push your bedtime back that much later if you're willing to get up a bit earlier the next day. So I think there's something about really trying to fit your timings in line with your circadian rhythm. And that is something we would always check with people. Are you a night owl? Are you somebody that tends to find that you get sleepy later on and you like a bit of a lie in the next day? Or are you a morning lark where you're much better in the mornings, but you're, you know, going to fall asleep on the couch in the evening? Or are you somewhere in between? And we also have a minimum amount of time that we wouldn't go below. So usually we say 5 hours. Even if you're not getting 5 hours of sleep, we'd normally say 5 hours has got to be the minimum amount of time to spend in bed. But as you can imagine, if that works, then you can get 5 hours of deep sleep, like all consolidated sleep rather. And sometimes people say, that's amazing. You know, I've been able to have 5 hours of sleep. And then what you would do once you get your consolidated sleep, where it's you're not waking up so much during the night, you would start to gradually increase how much time you're spending in bed. You're almost trying to trick your brain into thinking you're not spending any longer in bed. You're sort of trying to eke it out. So you might spend 15 minutes extra in the morning, or 15 minutes you'd go to bed a bit earlier. So you're gradually, over the next couple of weeks, trying to stretch your sleep. So that you're, but so much so that your brain hasn't quite realized that that's what it's doing.
Very cool.
But the other side of CBTI, which I should mention, is the cognitive part. So this is really about what do we do about the thoughts, you know, those thoughts that really get in the way of our sleep. And I would say, you know, over and above, this is the most challenging bit, because being able to sort of respond to all those unhelpful thoughts and ideas that come into your mind at night is really, really hard. We really want to retrain your brain that actually nighttime is not the time for worrying and thinking, and that let's do that earlier in the evening. So say, you know, 6 or 7 o'clock, you might put some time aside, and you would encourage people to sit down and really write out what is going on in your mind, what's going to come up later. Let's preempt all those thoughts and worries and everything that's going to come up.
That makes me feel stressed out, right?
But I think if you're already doing it at nighttime, it's really about saying, well, look, we can't get away from thinking, worrying. This is a natural part of what's going to happen for us. We are human. It's going to happen. Let's just put some boundaries around it. So one of the things that we would say is let's put 20 minutes aside. And that is your 20 minutes for thinking and worrying about stuff. And then, you know, we can shut the book, put that away. And then, of course, the thoughts and worries often do still show up later. But when they do, you can say to yourself, it's okay, I've done my worrying for today. I'm now not going to focus on that. I'm now just going to focus on rest. It's almost like giving yourself permission. There's a whole load of strategies which I think are so helpful and important with sleep.
I was just going to say, I had heard on a podcast that the Navy SEALs use a 4-7-8 breath work pattern, and they fall asleep within 10 minutes. So I've been trying that when I'm up at night, and I don't necessarily do it for 10 minutes because I get bored. It just calms me down a bit. So it's been helpful.
That's great, because you know there's real science behind that with the breathing work, and there's different strategies. There's box breathing. There's now this one that you know, Andrew Huberman talks about, the cyclical sigh, which is where you take two short in-breaths and then you breathe out. These are really good ways of drastically and very quickly bringing your heart rate down. And it's one of the strategies that we often speak to people about when they have panic attacks, and how to calm their heart rate down. So those sorts of deep breathing exercises are really, really helpful at bringing your heart rate down. And if you think about what do you need to sleep, we need our body to feel safe. You know, if we think about what we would have been feeling as cave people, it would not have been safe to go to sleep if we thought that there was a bear or a tiger around the corner. We would have stayed awake for that. So we need to do everything we can to almost allow our body and our brain to feel safe. And actually, the drop in the body temperature by 1 or 2 degrees is one of the best ways of signaling to our brain that it's time for sleep.
We know lots of people who would love to work with you. Please tell us about the Good Sleep course that you're going to be offering.
So we have for ages tried to think about how we could reach more people. So we, you know, we still are limited by people that can come to the Good Sleep Clinic, can see us online in the UK. So what we did was we recorded videos of us taking people through all the really important steps of CBTI and learning all about so much more about how sleep is affected in the perimenopause, about how hormone therapy might be useful, about all sorts of things. And we've recorded these videos and we've also recorded loads of sort of troubleshooting hints and tips as well that we see day to day in our sleep clinic. And we're putting it all together in the form of a course. And it will hopefully be launched in the next couple of months. So we're hoping that by May, it should be out and anybody can access that.
Sounds exciting. Amazing. Thank you. I'm going to change up the last question just a wee bit. But what are a few of the tips, quintessential tips that perimenopausal women need to know about sleep and sleep hygiene and getting a good night's sleep?
This is a good one. And I think that one of the key things about sleep for people in the perimenopause is about making sure that you wake up at a regular time each day, every day, if you can. So this is really to try and help getting away from, you know, extending your sleep and catching up on your sleep. And this kind of actually makes our sleep over the course of a week and a month and longer much more fractious. So if you can keep a regular wake up time, that really helps to keep your sleep pressure high. So that would be my first tip. Wouldn't you say, Zoe?
Yeah, absolutely. I think regularity is so important. And I think my tip would be to think about things that you're doing in the day, particularly about what you're putting into your body. So we know about caffeine being tricky for sleep, but it also can make perimenopause symptoms worse as well. So things like palpitations, anxiety. So really watching the caffeine. And again, when people aren't sleeping, they do sometimes drink a little bit more alcohol in the evening because wine, you know, can help you fall asleep a bit faster. It does at the beginning of the night, but it does have a really negative knock-on effect later in the night and causes lots of little wakings through the night. So be really careful with those things. And often it makes hot flushes, night sweats worse, and it just makes people feel a bit grotty in the perimenopause. We don't process alcohol so well. And another daytime thing is we know it is the phase of life where people do reduce their activity. So the average step count reduces over the perimenopause. And these things just happen naturally, partly because people are feeling a bit crappy and they just don't have the motivation. They're not feeling so good. But that, again, it will impact on your sleep. And we know that exercise and activity can help boost the sleep drive and it can lead to a much better night's sleep. So thinking about what you can do in the daytime is really important.
And then I would say one last one is just about, you know, if you do find yourself awake in the middle of the night and you're lying in bed, just willing yourself to go back to sleep. Just don't leave it so long that you're there for hours and hours. You know, get up, go and do something different, read a book, and then try again a little while later.
Do you guys sleep well?
Oh, I love that question. I do sleep well, but I have one experience of insomnia when I was when I just had my first child, and I remember it so clearly because it only lasted a few days, but it was the pressure to go back to sleep before she woke up again. It just built and built and built. And I was like, I've got to go back to sleep. And I just found that pressure was just so great. And in the end, I stayed awake the whole night and then the next night and the next night until I essentially was able to somehow fix my way of thinking. And I sort of allowed myself to take the pressure off. I said, oh, you know, if you don't get out of your pajamas tomorrow, then it's okay. You know, don't worry about being on form. Just get through. Just be good enough tomorrow.
I generally sleep well, but I do have nights where I don't. And weirdly, I actually get a bit excited when that happens because I think, oh, now I can try out my new technique. And And so I literally will be like, right, bring on the breathing, bring on the body scan, bring on the, and actually it gives me an opportunity to practice things. So I sort of don't mind it.
That's amazing.
Thank you both so much. This has been fantastic.
Thank you for having us.
I think we have to have you back.
Yeah, like, can we talk for 10 more hours?
Oh, we'd love to. We'd love to come back. Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to the show. If you like what you hear, please take a moment to rate and subscribe to our podcast. When you do this, it helps to raise our podcast profile so more women can find us and get a little better understanding of what to expect in perimenopause.
We also read all the reviews, the good, the bad, and the ugly, to help us continuously improve our show. We would love to hear from you. You can connect with us through the podcast, on social media, or through our website. Our information, as well as links and details from our conversation today, can be found in the show notes.
This podcast is for general information only. It's designed to educate, inspire, and support you on your personal journey through perimenopause. The information and opinions on this podcast are not intended to be a substitution for primary care, diagnosis, or treatment. The information on this podcast does not replace professional healthcare advice. The use of the information discussed is at the sole discretion of the listener. If you are suffering from symptoms or have questions, please consult a qualified healthcare practitioner.